This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4.
Hello, thank you for being with us. Labour made many promises ahead of coming to power, including, as part of what they call a new deal for working people, a review of parental leave within their first year in office. And close on their heels is the campaign group Dadshift, most recently responsible for attaching life-size model babies in slings to bronze statues of men across central London. They say 2 weeks of paternity leave is just not enough, and they're encouraging parents to sign an open letter calling on the Prime Minister to back a new paternity leave policy that's fit for the 21st century. A conversation about that coming up, but in the meantime, we do want to hear from you about your experiences. Did you or your partner take parental leave or paternity leave? How did you make the most of those early days with a new baby and holding down a job? How did you make it work? And are you happy with the current policy? What changes would you like to see? You can text the programme. The number is 84844. Over on social media, we are on the handle at BBC Women's Hour. That's on X and Instagram. You can email us through our website. And of course, you can send us a WhatsApp message or audio note using the number 03700 100 444. All of our terms and conditions can be found on our website. Also coming up this morning, Leanne Moriarty, the Australian author of 10 novels, perhaps best known for writing Big Little Lies, which was turned into the HBO TV series starring Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon. She will be talking about her latest book, Here One Moment. It looks at the fallout of a flight where each passenger is told how and when they will die. And as Levi's 501s are voted the iconic jean style of all time in one new poll, and high-rise flare jeans are predicted to have a major comeback according to this week's Paris Fashion Week, we want to talk about denim wars. Which is it? The skinny, the maternity, the mum jeans? Or how about the brand of leopard print jeans released this month with a 12,000 strong wait list? Maybe you're on that list waiting for your pair. Do get in touch. Which style makes the cut for you? But first, this week, we learned that the Taliban are to be taken to the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, for gender discrimination by Canada, Australia, Germany and the Netherlands. This is the first time that the UN's court has been used by one country to take another to court over gender discrimination. Afghanistan was taken over by the Taliban 3 years ago in August 2021. This was after the withdrawal of US troops from the country and the collapse of its government. And since then, the Taliban have curbed the rights of women and girls. Last month, a new set of morality laws were introduced, banning women from even speaking outside the home. Here to talk about this with me is Lise Doucette, the BBC's chief international correspondent. Good morning, Lise.
Good morning, Krupa.
How significant is this legal move to go to the ICJ?
This is a landmark move, and in two respects. One, it's in legal history. It is the first time that the International Court of Justice, which is essentially the world court of the United Nations based in The Hague, it's the first time it's been used by one country to take another to court over gender discrimination. In this case, as you mentioned, Canada, Australia, Germany and the Netherlands against Afghanistan. Landmark because this represents yet another attempt, because all of the others are just not working, to try to push, persuade, because they have said they will also try to negotiate with the Taliban about this, to overturn a raft of restrictions which deepen and expand month after month in Afghanistan. You mentioned what is only the latest morality code that was published by the emir's spiritual leader, Haibatullah Akhundzada, that is being described outside the country and by Afghan women, including Afghan women in the diaspora, as gender apartheid, gender genocide even. And it's not the only legal move that the Special Rapporteur for Afghanistan has recently issued a report in which he says that gender apartheid in Afghanistan, which he described as a systematic oppression and domination by one gender group over another, amounts to a crime against humanity. So a second legal move, which is already underway, to say that this is so outrageous and against all legal and moral norms that it should be classified as a crime against humanity.
Lise, we know that this is not the first time that the Taliban have been extensively criticised by international players for their treatment of women. As you say, the ICJ is that permanent court of the UN, but just explain to us how binding their rulings are.
Well, it certainly would send a very strong message. It would also give legal weight, legal pressure to any countries which could be considering a recognition of the Taliban. And now, a little bit more than 3 years after the Taliban swept into power on August the 15th, 2021, no single country has recognized them. So it would add equal pressure. But what really matters, Krupa, is does it change the lives of Afghan women and girls? And judging by the record of Taliban leaders so far, and when I say the leaders, I mean a small group of ultra-conservative clerics who are being criticized even by, I can safely say, because and when I go to Afghanistan, I discuss this with even founders of the Taliban who don't agree with these. They're conservative, but they understand that it is a different world now and that the Taliban have to be part of this world. And they have the Taliban leadership at the very, very top. And it's a highly centralized organization. No one can challenge, at least they haven't done so far, and they say they cannot challenge, the edicts of the emir. So it doesn't seem likely that this one will have any more force than another, but it is chipping away at the Taliban's. They keep saying, and this week again, they said, why are we not at the United Nations General Assembly? Why are we not allowed to take up our seat? This is, you know, illegal that we're being banned. And the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who attended some of these meetings with Afghan women, including the meeting with the foreign ministers who launched this new legal move, said you cannot take your seat at the world's table until you respect the norms of the international community, including, it must be said, the Muslim world. Afghanistan is the only country in the world where girls are not allowed to go to school past primary school, past grade six, and where women are barred from higher education and a whole lot of other restrictions too.
Considering all of what you've just said, this mission on the part of the Taliban to seek international legitimacy, they want to engage with states, with institutions, and we know just how much funding they've lost from key donors in recent years and how this has impacted women. Do you think they might take heed of any ICJ ruling, considering that legitimacy that it seeks?
Some of them might, you know, and I so don't want to say, Krupa, that it's going to fail. But they don't live by the rules of these courts. Take another example of pressure that's been put on them. In the early months, when it became clear that despite the promises of Taliban leaders who took part in negotiations in the Gulf state of Qatar, that they were a different kind of organization than the kind of medieval rule of the mid 1996 to 2001. But what is happening is that month after month, it's becoming clear that the only way they are different from the last time they ruled is that they actually are even worse, and they have more tools to implement their rules. So there has been a succession of delegations from the world's international Islamic bodies, Islamic scholars and clerics from countries around the world have spoken to Taliban leadership, have urged them, have said to them that under the Islamic holy book, the Quran, women must be educated. And what the Taliban always say, they want to boast that their Islam is much better. And they fall back on a term in Pashto, which is called urf, which means it's not just about Islam, it's about our customs and traditions. So even that, the appeals of their Islamic brothers and sometimes sisters have not been of to any avail. I traveled a year ago with the Amina Mohammed, who's the Deputy Secretary General, who is British Nigerian, who's a Muslim herself. And I watched as she went in and out of meetings with senior clerics, arguing with them point after point, the Islamic holy book, the Quran, that she knew and in some ways knew better than they did. And they kept pushing back. So I think this newest move group comes out of a desperate question, desperate most of all, for the girls and women in a country where rates of suicide are rising. You know, I challenge any of our listeners right now, whatever the age you are, indeed, whatever your gender is, if you were forced to stay at home, we're told you cannot speak loud or sing loud because someone outside your house may be listening to you. If all of your dreams were crushed, if you can't go to public parks, you can't even go to women's only gyms, I defy you to say, what would you want to do? What would you do? Which is why women in the diaspora, and bravely women in Afghanistan too, are raising their voices and saying, help, we need, literally it's an SOS for help. So this is what this new, they're trying politically, they're trying through negotiations, and now they're trying to use the world's legal tools, legal weapons, to try to get the Taliban to move.
You mentioned the public parks there, and someone else who mentioned those was the Hollywood actress Meryl Streep last week, who commented that a cat has more freedom than a woman in Afghanistan. She said, a cat may go and sit on her front stoop and feel the sun on her face. She may chase a squirrel in the park. A squirrel has more rights than a girl in Afghanistan because the public parks have been closed to women and girls by the Taliban. A bird may sing in Kabul, but a girl may not in public. And she's talking about this being a suppression of the natural law. But of course, we know, Lise, that there are endless men and women around the world speaking out for Afghan women and girls. I wonder how useful you think it is when celebrities speak out like this, in your opinion.
It was very interesting that, when Meryl Streep spoke about cats and squirrels, some Afghan women who held prominent positions in the last government, you know, ambassadors, and they said, we're not cats and squirrels, we're lions, we're tigers. And because Afghan women are trying to raise their voices ever higher after, it has to be said, a period where many were so traumatized, they were hardly able to speak. They're finding their voices now. What the Taliban always say is they say, we are under Islam, we are protecting Afghan women. They put out their new decrees, but the way they describe protection, it refers to marital consent, widows, remarriage, the dowry, inheritance, and those kind of things. So they're pushing back by codifying it. Whether or not, do celebrities outside the country, will they have, they certainly, people look up. I think, at a time when this is not just an Afghanistan issue, how can any of us accept a world in which women and girls are not being educated? And again, I emphasize, this is not just Britain or Canada or the West. This is the broader international community. The more that voices like Meryl Streep, because some people won't pay any attention. Who's this Afghan woman? I don't know this. Oh, Afghanistan again. My goodness. What a place. It never changes. They're always fighting. Or then they say, oh, Meryl Streep is involved. I think sometimes, and it was not just that she was involved, she didn't just do a hashtag. She went to the meetings with Afghan women. She discussed with them. She spoke to at the United Nations. It was a very considered intervention. And it's not about an issue which is far away from any of us. It is all of our issue. So in some senses, she's intervening, not just on behalf of Afghan women, but on the rights of women everywhere, because Krupa, you know, from week in, week out on Women's Hour, many other programs of the BBC, this is not a perfect world for women by any stretch of the imagination. But what the United Nations is saying, what this new intervention by the foreign ministers, three of them happen to be women, but it's not just a gender issue. And now more and more celebrities are saying is that these are fundamental rights of our time. Afghanistan can be a conservative country. And I've spoken so many times to conservative members of the Taliban who say, you know, they do want a conservative country. They want women to be dressed in ways that perhaps you or I wouldn't want to dress. They want perhaps at schools for the girls and boys to be separated. But they still believe women should be educated. Women should work. One leading member of the Taliban, a founding member of the Taliban, told me on my recently, he said, Lise, 95% of the Taliban don't agree with these edicts. And so I think in the end, unless the Taliban themselves, who are now fully in charge, unless they within themselves find a way to challenge, to go against their leader, and there's no sign of this, although we hear they do speak to, go down to Kandahar in the south of the country to speak to him in his little bubble, if you like, really a world of his own, then this is not going to change. But all of the noise around it helps. Even though lastly, and I'm sorry, I'm going on, but when it comes to the recognition of the Taliban feel they're inching in a way which is recognition in all but name. The Chinese have accredited the new Taliban ambassador to Beijing. The United Arab Emirates has accredited a new Taliban ambassador in the United Arab Emirates. The Chinese and other countries, Pakistanis, the Russians, they're going and they're investing in Afghanistan. And the United Nations is having meetings with the Taliban, and they've been much criticized. Although when it comes to the meetings with the Taliban, I say they do have human rights and the women's issues on the agenda. And there are many who say, don't cut them off completely. Keep talking. Hmm. The only way is just to keep talking and to hope that somehow Afghans themselves will be able, with the help of the international community, will be able to address and to ease the suffering, the unimaginable suffering of Afghan girls and women.
Well, we're so fascinated to get your insights on Afghanistan, a country that you know so well. Whilst we have you, Lise, I do want to take the opportunity to get your thoughts on what is happening in Lebanon at the moment with the Israeli strikes against the militant group Hezbollah. Of course, they have been cross-border fire between the two since the 8th of October last year. And now this escalation in recent days, more than 600 people across Lebanon and thousands more have been displaced, 90,000. And of course, we know women and children again caught up in these strikes. Always the most vulnerable.
I've been saying for many years that women and children are not on the front line. They are the front line. And I'm sure many listeners have seen the images of the traffic gridlock coming from the south of Lebanon, people fleeing for their lives, packing everything into a car, going somewhere, nowhere, many not knowing where they can find shelter. Some of them having received messages from the Israelis to leave their homes, to go somewhere safe, to get out of harm's way. Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel said, you know, there's a rocket launcher in your yard, there's missiles under your house, get out of the way. And it's a very, very complicated political picture. You know, international experts would say, yes, Israel has a right to defend itself, but there are also rules of war that you have to take precautions not to harm civilians, which is why there was so much concern and questions being asked when there was this so-called pager attack, when handheld pagers were exploding in the hands of Hezbollah members. But they were exploding in markets and close to children, and so children also died. So when that figure that you cited of people died, yes, Hezbollah members are being killed, but they're also including women and children. Later today, we're going to hear from Prime Minister Netanyahu, who's now under pressure from the international community. He'll speak to the United Nations General Assembly, and he's expected to mention the pressure, the calls for his most important allies, including the United States, for a three-week ceasefire to allow some diplomacy to intervene, to try to resolve this issue through negotiations and not through military means. But in Israel, there's even the public are saying we want to stop the rocket fire from Hezbollah into Lebanon. We want the 60,000 people on the Israeli side of the border to return to their homes. And on the other side, there had been about 100,000 who had also been forced to leave their homes. And now the figures are rising by the day. So, with every war, with every confrontation, military confrontation, it is at the same time a humanitarian catastrophe. And so it is unfolding now in Lebanon.
Thank you so much, Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent, with her expertise there on what is happening in Afghanistan and also in Lebanon. 2 weeks is not enough. That is the view of the Dad Shift. That is a new campaign calling for longer and more affordable paternity leave. Last week, they made headlines by attaching life-size model babies in slings to statues of men across London to raise awareness of the issue. Research has suggested that a third of dads took no paternity leave after the birth of their child, and Labour in their manifesto said that they would review the parental leave system within their first year in government. Joining me to discuss how current parental leave policies are working or failing for parents, particularly men, are George Gabriel from the Dad Shift campaign, Scott Ingalls, a lecturer, parent and trade union representative for University and College Union, and Dr. Sarah Forbes, director of the Equal Parenting Project at the University of York. Welcome to you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
George, I'll start with you. Why was it so important to set up this campaign?
Well, I think as you've overviewed, I mean, the UK offers dads just 2 weeks of paternity leave at less than half the minimum wage. Self-employed fathers get absolutely nothing. We are bottom of the league table. We have the worst offer for new dads and co-parents in all of Europe. We're 40th out of 43 across the OECD. And this isn't good enough. There's a kind of growing mountain of evidence put together by amazing organisations like Pregnant Then Screwed, the Fawcett Society and the Fatherhood Institute, showing that paternity leave is good for dads, it's good for mums, it's good for babies. With Labour offering this review up, we think there's a kind of once in a decade opportunity to really level up the offer for new parents. And so we want to build as many kind of voices as possible calling for change.
And when you say level up the offer, what do you mean?
Well, we think we should have a parental leave system that sets up new dads and co-parents to take a decent chunk of time. We think it should be affordable for them to take. So 2/3 of dads who do take paternity leave currently report financial distress as a result. So we think it should be substantial, affordable, and it should give couples the opportunity to parent in an equal way if that's something they want to choose to do. If we look around Europe, there's plenty of examples of people doing it better because literally everyone is doing it better. One country that I find very impressive is in Sweden. When a new baby arrives, if it's a single parent household, 480 days are given. If it's a couple, both partners get 90 days, use it or lose it, and then 180 days that they can share between them on the basis of what makes sense for them and their family. So we think there's a real opportunity to level up the offer. And we also think at a time like this, when we're trying to return the country to growth through focus on productivity, helping families thrive, helping parents get in the game, giving them the time they need to bond with their babies, get through those crazy early weeks,
they are crazy, aren't they?
And then show up to work as they would want to, is the right thing to do.
Yeah. Scott, let me bring you in here. You are dad to 17-month-old Esme, no doubt keeping you very busy. You were offered 2 weeks of paternity leave. How easy was that to take?
The parental leave, the mandatory parental leave, that was easy to take. Where we got into a little bit of where it became more complex was the decision that my wife and I took to share parental leave. And that became more of an issue. So what I had to do was I took my 2 weeks parental leave, and then I took 2 weeks leave, and then we split Claire's maternity leave, which gave us a total of around about 17 weeks before our baby was in nursery and we were back to work.
A balancing act, which is what this message also supports. The father's role is to support the baby's mother in the early months. After 9 months in the mother's body, the baby is primed to seek out her mum's milk, voice, smell and touch. And decent dads support the mother's infant days, knowing that it is the best start for their child. Decent dads don't try to usurp the relationship or push mum back to work with a tiny baby. I was glad my husband had a 2-week paternity leave holiday when our children were born. He didn't try to push me out of this precious time. He was a long supportive dad and husband. Thank you for your many messages that are coming in. George, what was your situation? You've got a 16-month-old.
Yeah, I had 4 months off and I'm incredibly grateful to my employer for giving me that. It was totally indispensable. You know, it meant I was there for the weeks after our baby was born. My wife had a C-section, couldn't go up and down the stairs. So I was really practically needed around the house. 6 weeks, we had an accident and our baby cracked her head and had to take her to hospital, and turned out she had a fracture, bleeding on her brain. It was a horrendous time for us, but it meant, you know, the leave I was given meant I could be there for 5 days and nights in the hospital while we waited to learn that she would be okay. So it meant I was there in the really important moments, but also in the kind of more pedestrian everyday. Honestly, when people ask me what I did with the time, I say I argued and argued and argued with my wife till we figured out how we were going to parent together in a way that felt great to both of us, was equal, was balanced. And that journey of learning to become parents, I'm in awe, honestly, of the families and dads who managed to do this with so much less than I had. And it's time that we fixed it. It's not good enough.
Sarah, let me bring you in here. There have been changes recently to the 2 weeks paternity offer. What are they and what difference are they making, if any?
Right. So previously, paternity leave was 2 weeks, so 1 or 2 weeks at statutory pay, which is around £184 a week. And what was happening originally was that people or fathers or non-birthing parents were able to use this within the first 56 days. What has changed is that fathers now and non-birthing parents are able to actually split that time, so they can actually use 1 week, for example, after the birth or adoption of their child, and then they can use another week later within the year. So they're able to use that within the first 52 weeks. It's, you know, still to be determined what effect that will have. But what we do know is that parents do appreciate flexibility. So being able to use leave when is most suitable for them and enabling parents to have that choice is important. But, you know, just to kind of highlight some points, it's really great to hear that Gabriel and Scott were able to take the time with their children. But it is important to emphasise that this is something that has been, at the present time, organisation-led. We've got so many companies around the UK now recognising the important role that fathers and non-birthing parents have. And it should be that this is more accessible to the rest of those fathers that don't have the finances, because that is a key barrier that is preventing dads.
Well can I put this to you from Rachel? She says, sometimes you don't get any time off as a father if you haven't worked for the workplace for a certain amount of time. This is shocking. We need a family-centred society. And a question from Kate, one of our listeners on X, who says, is paternity leave available 100% to all parents? And if not, why not? Can you just explain that to us?
So there is eligibility criteria that has to be met. So duration of work, duration of employment is one of them. And yes, I myself, so my colleague, co-director of the Equal Parenting Project alongside me, Holly Burkett at the University of Birmingham, her and I conducted research and, you know, we often found ourselves talking to fathers and non-birthing parents that actually were saying they were excluded from taking paternity leave because they didn't meet that eligibility criteria. And that is absolutely terrible, because that was a time that's really precious to them, to spend time with their partner, to spend time with their child, and to hear stories where they actually aren't even able to have that quality time with their child, coming home with the child in the crib, falling asleep, you know, and they miss that. They miss it entirely. So again, you know, this is something that's, you know, important to highlight that, and you raised this at the beginning, the fact that the Labour Party is going to be having a review within their first year. So I'm hoping that they will hear these voices, they will hear and recognise the importance of addressing the eligibility criteria, the duration of leave, the pay that is offered to fathers and non-birthing parents. Because so often that is actually excluding them from an experience that is so important, that time with their family.
And that term missing out comes up time and time again. Scott, I know that you took some paternity leave, but then you got to a point where you could no longer afford to take it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, after 17 weeks, unfortunately, we would have dropped to statutory only, and we simply couldn't afford that. My wife is an incredible woman, but she had a really difficult pregnancy. She had a C-section, and with all that that entails. Esme had to be admitted straight to SCBU because she was premature and she had congenital pneumonia, and we had 2 weeks of worrying in SCBU special care baby unit before she was discharged home. And then, in that all that Claire, my wife, she was trying to establish breastfeeding, and because Esme was so small, that was a real issue. We wanted to do all sorts of things. We wanted to take Esme to sing and sign and baby swimming and baby massage, and frankly, we didn't have time to do any of that because we were back to work. Our shared parental leave was set up in quite a weird way, I guess. Less than 5% of people, of parents, take shared parental leave, according to the Dad Shift stats. Thank you very much for them. And it was incredibly complex to organise, but it meant that after the initial 4 weeks, I was back to work for a week, and then I would take a week's leave while Claire went back to work, and we leapfrogged it a week at a time. Until the 17 weeks was up. So even though we're talking about shared parental leave, the way we had to work it to get any decent time off, and again, this isn't to do with our employer or anything like that. It's the way that the system is set up. It wasn't really true shared parental leave at all.
And I think your story highlights that you just don't know what challenges you're going to face when you have a baby. You have all these plans for baby massage and other things. And then, like you were saying, George, your baby can have an accident, can fall unwell. Mother might be unwell. We've got this message from a listener who says, I'm on maternity right now with my 3-week-old recovering from a C-section, and my partner has just gone back to work. Paternity is so old school. His employer asked for 4 weeks' notice of when he was going to take the leave, but a due date isn't a definitive date. I ended up being 1 week and 5 days late, so we had even less paternity. It's just unfair on fathers, but leaves mothers in the luck too. Makes me wonder if it's linked to mothers' anxiety for wanting medical interventions to get labour started. Really interesting point. Thank you for your message. You must hear stories like this all the time, George.
Yeah, and I mean, it's appalling. It's outrageous. As Sarah said, there are some companies already stepping up, giving decent enhanced offers, and that's fantastic. But if you're a local small business, if you're the pub down the road, that's where you need government help. So we're calling on government to level up the UK's paternity leave offer because of stories like this. It's not good enough for British families, and it's not good for the society either. Keir Starmer, during the general election, was attacked for trying to spend Friday nights with his kids. And he defended his right to do so really robustly. And that's why we're pretty confident that now's the time, and he's the Prime Minister, to deliver this change. He's a dad. He knows what it's like. He's spoken on record about how important that time is. So surely he can see the point of other fathers and co-parents across the country. So we're excited to take this message to him. We're excited for Labour's review, and we think something really serious can be done.
Sarah, on that point made by Scott about the number of people taking up shared parental leave being so low, I know that you've been speaking to employers and parents as part of your work. What have you found?
So we've seen that more organisations, as George mentioned, are actually, recognising the important role of, of leave after the birth or adoption of the child for fathers and non-birthing parents. And they have stepped up. They have more organisations are enhancing pay, and there is a reason for it, that it's not completely selfless. There is the recognition that it is a means of attracting and retaining top talent. But there's also, the idea that it may improve organization commitment, in terms of that talent retention. And also just in terms of the experience of fathers being, better supported. So you're actually seeing organizations, implement programs, so coaching on the return to work and things like that. So it's very encouraging, very positive feedback from organizations, and it's it's something that should be more readily available to more fathers across the UK. So, you know, let's see what happens.
One thing I want to put to all of you before we wrap up this conversation is, if there was one thing that you think needs to be done to make the system more workable and better off for all, what would that be, George?
So we're looking forward to engaging with government on the range of options. I see amazing organisations like Fatherhood Institute and Pregnant and Screwed making the case that we should have 6 weeks for dads. So that dads should be offered, and co-parents too, 6 weeks, use it or lose it at 90% the rate of pay, to use at any point within the first year of a child's life. That would be a really substantial levelling up of Britain's offer to new fathers and to families, while at the same time recognising that we're in a context of constrained public finances. So we're really hoping the government's going to place that bet on British dads, British families, and level this thing up.
Scott, one thing to make it more workable.
I'm going to cheat. I'm going to agree with George, but I'm also going to make a pitch for it to be much less complex to sort out.
Yeah.
Just now, our shared parental leave arrangements are screamingly complex, and they could be simplified, and they should be simplified.
Mm. So simplifying the bureaucracy around it, yeah. Essentially. Yeah. Yeah. And Sarah?
I think it's really important that we listen to fathers and non-birthing parents, but also to recognise that, yes, exactly what George was saying, we do need to improve the duration of leave, the pay that's offered, and also recognise that flexibility is a means with which we can better support families in the UK.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sarah Forbes, Scott Ingalls, and George Gabriel, for your time here talking about parental leave policies. No doubt that conversation will continue, as it is on our social media pages. So many of you are getting in touch to react to this. I'd like to squeeze in a couple of more here. Parental leave. I'm glad one or two people have focused on the mother's health. There's a bit too much creeping general diminution of the huge physical and psychological impact of childbirth on women. Maternity leave was brought in to safeguard women's health, not just the baby. This may have been forgotten. Thank you for your messages. Do keep them coming in. And just on that, the Department of Business and Trade spokesperson has said the government has set out an ambitious agenda to overhaul workers' rights and make work pay, and we will introduce a new employment rights bill within the first 100 days. Our plan is committed to strengthening parental leave, and we will review the whole system to ensure the parental leave offers the best possible support for working families.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's role as the world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Do keep your messages coming in. That text number is 84844, and on social media we are at BBC Women's Hour, and of course you can email us. Next, what would happen if a mysterious woman on a flight began predicting the deaths of her fellow passengers? This is the premise of best-selling author Leanne Moriarty's latest novel, Here One Moment. Leanne is author of 10 novels, which have sold more than 20 million copies worldwide. They include Big Little Lies, which is also an Emmy and Golden Globe winning HBO series produced by and starring Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon. Her novel, Apples Never Fall, is also now a TV series currently on BBC iPlayer. Happy to say Leanne joins me now live in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Before we talk about your work, I'd love to hear a reading from Here One Moment.
Sure. So I'm just going to read the very first sentence of the novel and then skip ahead. Later, not a single person will recall seeing the lady board the flight at Hobart Airport. The lady is small and petite, but not so small and petite as to require solicitousness. She does not attract benevolent smiles or offers of assistance. Looking at her does not make you think of how much you miss your grandmother. Looking at her does not make you think anything at all. You could not guess her profession, personality, or star sign. You could not be bothered. You wouldn't say she was invisible as such, maybe semi-transparent. The lady is not strikingly beautiful or unfortunately ugly. She wears a pretty green and white patterned collared blouse tucked in at the waistband of slim-fitting grey pants. Her shoes are flat and sensible. She is not unusually pierced or bejeweled or tattooed. She has small silver studs in her ears and a silver brooch pinned to the collar of her shirt, which she often touches as if to check that it is still there. Which is all to say, the lady who will later become known as the Death Lady on the delayed 3:20 p.m. flight from Hobart to Sydney is not worthy of a second glance, not by anyone, not a single crew member, not a single passenger, not until she does what she does. Even then, it takes longer than you might expect for the first person to shout, for someone to begin filming, for call buttons to start lighting up and dinging all over the cabin like a pinball machine.
Thank you. We are captured from the very opening.
I hope so.
An elderly lady walking down the aisle of a plane, telling each of her passengers when and how they will die. What inspired you? What's the idea behind this novel?
So I was actually on a flight myself out of Hobart, a delayed flight. And looking back, it was a time in my life when I was thinking about my own mortality, because in the years leading up to that day, a few things had happened. First of all, my sister was diagnosed with breast cancer. Then I lost my dad. Then we had the pandemic. And then I myself was diagnosed with breast cancer. So, and also I think just being in my 50s, it's a time in my life when I was thinking about mortality. And so when I was on that flight, I was looking around at the other passengers, and the cheerful thought came into my head that every single passenger on this flight was going to one day die. And so I was looking at everybody around me and I was thinking, will you be the person who makes it to 100? And will you be the person whose life is unexpectedly cut short? And then I was thinking about the fact that at some time in the future, somebody would be able to look back at all the names of everybody on that flight and list our age of death and our cause of death. So those are facts, or they just weren't available yet. And that's when it occurred to me, what if somebody stood up and shared that information right now?
Incredible how the seed of a story is planted. It really is. Tell us about Cherry.
So Cherry is the woman who stands up and shares that information. And we don't know at first anything at all about her. Most readers say they didn't like her much at the beginning. They're frightened. We don't know how she knows this information. She is the daughter of a very successful fortune teller. And then as the story evolves, most people love her by the end.
And she's the main character, but there are many other sub-characters around her. And usually in a novel, you'll have a handful of key characters. In this case, there are a multitude. Was that difficult to conjure up the personalities of all these different characters?
Well, I have a lot of characters in my novels, and I'm always thinking, okay, next time I'm going to write my next novel just from one character's point of view, and then I write 9 Perfect Strangers. Or then, as you say, I write a novel about a plane load of passengers. So it's just what I really enjoy doing, actually. So that's not, there are things that I found difficult where I needed to do research, such as one of the characters is a flight attendant, so I had to do a lot of research on that. But actually developing their personalities, that's the part that I love.
There is a line that stands out from the book, fate won't be fought, which raises the discussion about predictions, fate versus free will. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Since writing this novel, I've been talking to lots of people, and some people are such firm believers in fate, and they say everything happens for a reason. And obviously you can't argue with them, because everything that's happened was meant to be. And I think I like the idea of fate myself when I'm thinking about, I had to go through all those bad boyfriends to get the right one. I was always meant to be a novelist. But on the other hand, I think fate only works for lovely things. I don't think that I can look at terrible things on the news and think that was that person's fate, that was that child's fate for their life to end that way. So no, I don't. I'm not a believer in fate. I'm a believer in free will.
If you were on that plane and you were one of those passengers and Cherry was there predicting when and how you would die, would you want to know?
Well, it's interesting. I've come to realise that some people actually face that choice if they've got a genetic disorder in their family. And so, you know, some siblings decide they will do the testing and some decide they won't. I would want, if that was the case, and I need to look at it that way because I think like the characters in the book, if you were told by somebody on the flight, you wouldn't necessarily believe them. And all the way through, you'd be thinking, I don't believe it. But with genetic testing, where it would be real, I would want to know.
Yeah, it depends on the circumstances, doesn't it? Many of your novels have been adapted for TV successfully. How do you feel when you see the words brought to life on the screen?
It's a surreal feeling. It's fun. A lot of it for me has just been fun to be on the sidelines and to visit the set of Big Little Lies when they were filming the school trivia night. So to see Nicole as Celeste dressed exactly as I described her. Funnily enough, to see Reese as Madeline dressed quite differently, but I actually thought the wardrobe person got that right and that is how Madeline would have dressed. And to see the little props, to walk by two stuntmen who were practicing the murder scene, to talk to the caterer's mum. It was all just a good fun. And so I've just enjoyed it from the sidelines.
It's been hugely successful. And seeing as we're talking about Big Little Lies, there are mutterings of a third series. Can you shed any light?
All I can say is that I am definitely writing a sequel to the book. Mm-hmm. So when I wrote the first book, my children were little and they were just starting school. And now my children are teenagers. And so they're providing a wealth of teen material. So I'm writing a book set 10 years in the future.
Many of your books rely heavily on the themes of female relationships. And I wonder if that is drawn to any extent from your own personal relationships, including with your sisters who are also writers.
Yes, I've got two sisters who are also writers. I'm sure every author pulls on things from their life, whether it's friendships or family relationships. And I know with my very first novel, one of my sisters said, this one is you, this one is me, and this one is another sister. So, but I think as now I'm on to my 10th novel, you've got to start making things up at some point.
And 10th novel, there might be more coming because you have said in the past that, and I quote, to keep the page turners coming, you like to write a new novel every 2 years.
Oh, it's been actually, yes, it was 2 years for a while and then it became every 3 years.
Okay.
Yes, but Big Little Lies, the sequel, I might do that quicker.
Well, we await news on that. Thank you so much, Leanne Moriarty, on her latest novel, Here, One Moment. Thank you for coming in and joining us here in the Woman's Hour studio. The classic Levi's 501 jeans have been voted the nation's most iconic fashion piece of all time. Originally patented in 1873, the 501 recently celebrated its 150th year. And second to the jeans came the classic Ralph Lauren polo shirt ahead of the timeless Chanel little black dress. Joining me to talk about all things jeans is Lauren Cochran, a senior Guardian fashion writer, and Hannah Rogers, assistant fashion editor at The Times. Welcome to both of you.
Morning.
Lauren, I'll start with you. Why are the 501? Well, first of all, what are the 501s for those who don't know?
The 501s are the classic Levi's jeans. So the original shape that they, as you said, invented back in, 150 years
ago? Yeah, 1873. And why are they still doing so well, in your opinion?
I think that the classic status of them is why they're coming back. There's a lot of kind of interest from kind of people in their 20s for those kind of classic pieces that have what they sort of see as a kind of authenticity and timeless quality in fashion.
And when you say coming back, Hannah, I wonder whether you think they ever left the scene.
Well, I mean, I've had my Levi's 501s for, I think, nearly 10 years, and actually went and tried them on again earlier when I saw the news about them being the most iconic garment. And I can see why. I mean, they kind of have this relaxed fit, but it's still a rigid denim. It feels flattering. It felt flattering in my 20s. It still feels flattering now. And I think for many people who bought 501s originally, they won't have stopped wearing them because obviously not everyone pays attention to the fashion cycle in the way that perhaps Lauren and I do. Mm-hmm. But of the moment now, particularly, yes, they are, in the sense that these kind of like baggy, looser styles have come back into fashion. And so if you do have some in your drawer, it is a particularly good time to bring them out again.
Well, let's talk about the different styles. First of all, Paris Fashion Week is underway, and I've heard that it's all eyes on the baggy jeans, or the not just the baggy jeans, the flared jeans as well, which I wore when I was a teenager. Are they back in?
I think they have popped up on a few catwalks, yes. And I guess it's not that surprising because the kind of the baggier 90s jeans have kind of been coming back in over the past 18 months. And now designers are turning their attention to the flared style. But if you actually looked on the front row rather than the catwalk, I think you'd probably find that a lot of editors were wearing what is known as the horseshoe jean, which are terribly controversial. They are, as you can imagine, in the shape of a horseshoe. They're almost sort of bended out from the hips around the knees. I have to say that I have a pair. I can also tell you that every member of the Times fashion team also has a pair. I think to the average consumer, they look a little bit strange. And if you wanted to kind of try them in a more real world sense, it's more of like a barrel leg or a carrot leg that is really trendy.
Gosh, barrel leg, carrot leg, whatever, horseshoe. I mean, this is incredible. Is there an adjective that we don't associate with jeans? Well, let's talk about skinny jeans. Lauren, I have to say, I was delighted when the skinny jeans became less popular, and they're sitting in the back of my cupboard. I hope I never wish to wear them again. But do they ever go away?
I mean, I think there'll always be people that wear skinny jeans. For some people, it's just part of their look. And yeah, I mean, the sort of the accelerated fashion cycle that we live in now means that there are rumblings of the skinny jean coming back. Yes, it's definitely, I think with Gen Z, who originally kind of really roasted millennials for wearing skinny jeans, are sort of taking them up as a kind of ironic item to wear. So we'll see.
And then off the back of the skinny jeans, because people like me would moan that they're so uncomfortable, you got the jeggings. What do you make of that, Hannah?
God, well, you say jegging to me and I just think of Topshop's Jamie jeans from back in the day, which I was never out of when I was at university. You know, those really like high-waisted,
yes,
stretchy denim jeans, which I just thought were the coolest things on the planet, and I don't think I was alone in that. Am I an enormous fan of them currently? No. But if we had this conversation in 6 months, might I have changed my mind? It kind of depends what I see on the catwalks in the next week or so in Paris. It is as fickle as that. You know, there's a whole spectrum of denim out there, and we all have this obsession with our jeans. You know, we wear them so often. They really are a linchpin in our wardrobes. And I think everyone is very conscious of how a pair of jeans can.
And why is that? Being that linchpin, why do you think it's just that staple?
I think jeans have become something that a modern wardrobe, they're the backbone of a modern wardrobe in many ways. Jeans are no longer this casual item. You can easily wear your jeans to smart. Most of us, many of us, can wear our jeans to the office. And I just think we're really conscious of how, as I say, jeans can date your outfit, and no one wants to feel on the back foot. And in as much as it's difficult to find a pair of jeans that suit you anyway, and there is so much choice out there, you also want to feel that the pair that you love is the so forbidden right pair. And I just don't think that really goes away. I think it's quite psychological buying jeans.
Yeah. Talk about wide selection. There is one M&S pair of jeans, the leopard print jeans, that are currently sold out. There's 12,000 people waiting to get their hands on a pair of them. I don't know whether you guys have spotted them, but Lauren, what do you make of them and why are they so popular?
I'm actually in the middle of writing a piece about those very
Tell
jeans
us more. A preview, please.
Sorry.
Tell us more.
I think they are, they're sort of, they're kind of on, they've got like the halo effect of the Gani leopard print jeans that have been around for a while and very popular. And I think that the leopard print jean is kind of a new way of kind of doing denim, like printed denim is another kind of part of your, might be another part of your denim wardrobe. I'm actually wearing a pair of printed denim jeans today, mm-hmm. Which are kind of like a new part of my own wardrobe. So I think it's that. I also think it's kind of the sort of the wide leg, the combination of the wide leg and the leopard print is a sort of like win-win.
Someone said in the office this morning that leopard print is now a neutral. Would you agree?
Well, I've asked lots of people for the piece I'm writing and they would agree. So I would say yes.
Leopard print, the new neutral. Let me put this message from Natasha to you both. I'd like to highlight that denim production is one of the most unsustainable fashions, responsible for huge consumption of water. Shouldn't be worrying about that in the midst of a climate crisis. Thank you, Natasha, for your thoughts. Lauren, your thoughts on that material and denim?
Yeah, I mean, it is true. They do kind of zap a lot of water production. I believe Levi's are kind of attempting to sort of control that with the way that they produce jeans. But yeah, I mean, the other way that we can combat that obviously is by shopping secondhand. And secondhand Levi's are even better than the new one, in my opinion.
Yeah, and this message that speaks to my heart. Just hate the clingy, hot and sticky, elasticated fashion jeans. I've at last found some without the elastic after several years walking out of the shops. Hannah, your thoughts? The waist. It's all about the waist, isn't it?
It's all about the waist, and you've got to find the waistline that's comfortable for you. I mean, we've all worn a pair of jeans that halfway through the day we think, oh my goodness, I've got the worst tracked wind in the world. Why did I wear this size? I genuinely think, and I think we will see a return to people going to try stuff on in the shops more anyway because of the cost of returns now. But I do think it's worth spending time going in store and trying on lots of pairs, working out which pair is the most comfortable for you. On the high street, M&S and Bowdoin are actually really brilliant for that because they do stock jeans and they are sized by waist and by length. Or go to a denim specialist, go to a Levi's, and you know, I know it can be a bit torturous going into a changing room and trying on lots of pairs of jeans that maybe 95%
it does feel like that these days. Yes, yeah,
but it's worth doing.
Thank you so much for your tips there. That is Lauren Cochrane from The Guardian and Hannah Rogers from The Times for their insights there. Upon hearing the news that the Levi's 501 jeans have been voted the nation's most iconic fashion piece of all time. Thank you for all of your messages that keep trickling in. A lot of you getting in touch on the subject of paternity leave. Rebecca writes, regarding paternity leave, if my husband had taken 4 months paternity leave so he could stay home, we'd argue with me. Quite frankly, I'd rather he stayed at work. Thank you for your honesty there, Rebecca, and for sharing that with us. And this one, I got only 5 days of paternity leave for each of my children. I still feel nearly 30 years later that it has meant I don't have the relationship with my children that I should have. Again, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. Do keep your messages coming in at BBC Women's Hour. I am back tomorrow with Weekend Women's Hour, the very best of the week, and I do hope you will join me then. All that is coming up tomorrow after 4. Thank you for your company.
That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
None of them knew that she'd lived this double life. They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains in minus 40 degrees.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend. Helping people was in his blood.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes on BBC Sounds.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's role as the world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.